Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Artists Helping Artists. We are the number one art show on Blog Talk Radio. This is Leslie Seda in South Pasadena, and I have my November returning co-host, Dottie Leatherwood from Charlotte, on the line. Good morning, Dottie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back.
I was teaching a workshop in Charlotte last week and saw Dottie and couldn't resist and asked her if she wanted to be on the show for another month.
I know. I got to see you. That was great. I'm so glad you came over to our side of the world, from your side of the world.
Well, we
and
have to...
you had a lot of workshops going on.
I do.
I taught
two last week, one here in California and then one in Charlotte. But I have to confess that I have a son who's in college in just outside of Charlotte, so that was one of the reasons why I was in that neck of the woods. And then I'm teaching one next week in Newport Beach. So I'm not sure why I'm teaching three workshops in 1 month. What I was thinking.
I can't imagine why.
Well, I had like another week in between. I don't know. But it's a little crazy. But I'm really excited because it has just been an amazing experience. I have a girl who took my workshop last week who's taking the one next week now.
That is great. Oh, wow.
Yes, she is an amazing artist just starting out and wants to come back for more. So she's a repeat offender, as we call her now.
Wow.
But, I'm excited. Very excited.
Yes.
And Dottie,
and
I know
you have a webinar coming up again?
I do. For those of you that don't know, I started in the month of September an online class called Webinarts. There's a little ART in there if you get it. And basically what was happening is from the radio shows, a lot of people were getting great ideas for trying to sell their art online and doing things. And then I would get a lot of emails every week saying, well, how exactly do I do this? How exactly do I do that? And I felt bad because I don't have time to answer everyone's emails. So I realized that there was a need for people to find out exactly how to do things. So I started a Marketing 101 class online. It was a month-long class that you can take at your pace, and it was 5 classes per week. And each class was lots and lots of videos of yours truly. And it was basically of my computer screen showing you exactly how to build a website, how to improve your blog, how to set up a fan page on Facebook, how to advertise on Facebook, how to send out a newsletter, all those things. And the class was amazing. We had over 100 artists who were on a private blog, and every night at midnight, the next day's class would launch. And then I'd get 40 to 50 comments every day with questions, and I'd be answering those. And it was an amazing, very busy month for me, but really exciting. So that class is starting again in January. That was a really long answer to your comment, by the way.
No, it is such a great resource to have it all in one place.
It was wonderful. And just so you know, I still have people taking the September class because I'm still getting comments a lot. It's hard to stay up with it because there's so much to learn every day.
Right,
so a lot
yeah.
of people are behind, but they're not behind. That's why it's an online class. You can take it whatever you want to.
Right, at your own pace.
And if life gets in the way, which it does, then that's a good thing. So
thing to put on your Christmas list if you're an artist. Somebody's looking to get you something. Webinars would be a great thing.
And you can go to webinarts.net, and if you go to the Webinarts 101 class, there's a lot of comments in there from artists who took the class in September. And I was really nervous because I really wanted it to go well, and I probably overdid it because I had the classes kind of done before we started, but then every day, based on questions that came up, I kept adding more videos and adding things, and it went really well, so I'm very happy. So.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, and Dottie, I know you're busy with commissions and painting beautiful large paintings. If you want to see Dottie's art, be sure to go to Dottie Leatherwood, and you'll find her on Facebook, and you'll find her on her website too, but very, very talented artist.
Awesome.
You're welcome. So speaking of talented artists, we have a woman on the show today, Sherry McGraw, who is pretty amazing. I was telling her earlier, doing the research for the show was really intimidating because I'm going to read a little bit of her bio, and this is only a portion of it, and I could read it for about an hour, but she's been at the forefront of the American art scene for over 30 years. As a young woman in Oklahoma City in 1978, she was urged by her teachers, Richard and Edith Goetz, to move to New York to study at the famed Art Students League, where they'd studied within the lineage of Robert Brackman, George Bridgman. And in her initial years at the League, she studied primarily with legendary artist David LaFelle, but also learned anatomy through Robert Beverly Hill and John Zahorek, whose name I don't think I, who I pronounced correctly, at the New York Academy. And when you look at her work, you can see, obviously, she has studied anatomy. Her paintings are just unbelievable. But after just a few years in New York, she was already proceeding to make her own way as an exceptional artist and began exhibiting and winning awards and shows at the Salma Gundy Club, the National Arts Club, the Washington Square Outdoor Art Exhibit, the Pastel Society, the Hudson Valley Art Association, and many, many more. By the time she was 30, she was teaching classes at the Art Students League, having been asked to take over those of Thomas Fogarty and Gustav Rehberger, as well as conduct her own. Currently, McGraw teaches workshops throughout the country. She gives lectures and demonstrations for art institutions such as the Portrait Society of America, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art, Brigham Young University, the Art Students League of New York, and many, many, many more. Her work has shown in major institutions, including the National Museum of Wildlife Art, the Gilcrease Museum, the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, and the Tucson Museum, as well as numerous prestigious collections. She was also vice president of the American Woman Artists. McGraw is the author of the highly acclaimed book, The Language of Drawing, which we are going to talk about today, which has also been drawing worldwide attention and can be found at the Metropolitan Museum of Art bookstore in New York City. Sherry, welcome.
Hi. Hi, Leslie. I'm glad to be here.
That is an amazing bio.
Well, you know how bios are.
No, but still, it's amazing. And
well,
I actually
it is all I've done.
Congratulations on your amazing art career so far. But I know I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and I know we had to reschedule, but it is so terrific to have you here. But I read in an article that you knew you wanted to be an artist already at age 4. So I would love to know how you discovered art at such an early age and kind of the path that you took in those early years to kind of get you where you are today.
You know, it's interesting. My mom, I think, had a real artistic side to her. And while I don't think, you know, painting was what it was about, I think she was maybe more of a writer than mm-hmm. anything. But for some odd reason, in Ponca City, Oklahoma, she had like a complete set of William Shakespeare, you know, plays. She had this whole series from the Met that was kind of an instructional series on art, and just had different art books, you know. And so, it's just something I would, you know, pore through, you know, over mm-hmm. and look at. And I guess I was an unusual 4-year-old, or maybe not, I don't know. But I decided a lot of things when I was 4. And, you know, not the least of which was that I was going to be an artist. And, you know, and I think it was looking at these paintings and thinking that this is what I wanted to do. And she also had like a plaster cast of Michelangelo's self-portrait. She had a Rodin sculpture. She had a Tang, you know, an imitation Tang horse, which you'll find in my work,
yeah.
At least, you know, the real things now. But so somehow it's just that's what impacted me when I was young. And so when I was 4, I decided I, you know, would be an artist. And so I decided I wouldn't do anything that my mom had done because my mom had 7 kids. And I know. My mom had 7. I'm happy she had 7 kids. But I could see that it kept her from pursuing certain things. And so, you know, nothing against that, having children by any means. But I, that was also a decision I made at the age 4. I wasn't going to get married and I wasn't going to have kids. Because I was going to be an artist and nothing else.
Wow. And then
that's amazing.
Yeah, after that, did you study? I mean, did you do art all through, you know, schooling and then obviously ended up in New York, but...
Well, you know, I kind of kept it quiet. I think, you know, in Ponca City, Oklahoma, it just wasn't the way you were supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were supposed to, you know, get married and have children, and that was that was all a woman was supposed to do. So, and you were supposed to be married by, you know, 18, 19.
Right.
I mean, if you made it to 21 and you weren't married, it was really serious. You know, serious old maid time. So I think I was going against such a an overwhelming tide of, you know, cultural tendencies, you know, in my, you know, where I was growing up anyway. So I kind of kept it quiet. I think intuitively I knew that if that I couldn't talk about it or it would diffuse the energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very quiet. My mom knew about it, but I didn't think really anybody else did.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, I took one of those famous artist courses. At least I started it.
Yeah.
And somehow it didn't jive with me. I didn't end up doing that. But the fact that my mom was on it, you know, she knew this is what I wanted to do and was very supportive in that regard. Very supportive.
That's great.
Which was helpful, yeah.
Huh. How wonderful to know that at such an early age.
Yeah, she just somehow spotted it, you know.
Was your mother an artist?
Well, not, I mean, like I said, I think at her heart she was,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, you know, she was in tune with things that nobody I knew of in Ponca City, Oklahoma had any knowledge of, you know, just... you know, opera and Handel's Messiah and things that were just unusual for Ponca City, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was inspiring.
Yes, and then, of course, I just, you know, I went from there and I went to, I thought that the way to become an artist was through college. So I did attend a couple of years. And then I studied with Richard and Edith Getz, and they were in Oklahoma City, and they were terrific. They had been in New York and had that whole connection with the Art Students League and with the lineage that you talked about, you know, Brackman and Bridgman
mm-hmm.
and Henry Henschy, actually, which was a colorist. So they really came from a colorist background and impressionism. And while that wasn't the thing that really spoke to me, they were very influential in just the kind of lives that they led. It was unlike any people I had ever known. They were very unusual people and really had a profound effect, you know, on me just
mm-hmm.
for who they were as human beings. And then they were the ones that suggested the Art Students League. And then
from then on, it's history.
It's history. And the league is just the greatest place. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's such a great place. It hasn't really changed that much in all these years. Now maybe it's changing just a little bit, but it just has a great sense of history and great Northlight Studio, and people there are very serious. So it's a great atmosphere to have been studying in.
I love your approach, I guess, to painting and drawing and everything that I've read, and I've got a couple of your DVDs, and my book is on the way. It was my birthday this month, I treated myself to your book, so I'm so excited to read it, but I feel like it's such a spiritual thing with you, painting and drawing, and it's sort of I guess the best way to describe it is kind of in your own words, that you said being a better artist is not an accumulation of technique, but a way of seeing, of being, and that a painting is not separate from who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just such a wonderful approach to art, something that sometimes I think we forget. as artists. We lose sight of that. And you also are a big proponent of abstract realism. And the treatment of that. And I kind of wanted to get to explain that to maybe the listeners that don't know what that is, and if you could explain it to them, that would be great. It's
okay.
your description is that paint can be a piece of light. How it create air and dimension to create recognizable objects. So it's not about the object that you're painting. It's about what you can do through that.
Yes, well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, David and I have actually coined this term, and I think it's possible other people have in the world. I don't know, but we were trying to come up with something that that identified this quality that certain artists have had throughout the history of art. Not
mm-hmm.
all of them, but certain ones have had this certain sensibility that we thought was very different. And when I came to David to study with David, it was this quality that I was interested in. Now, I didn't know it. I mean, I just knew that when I saw it, I knew that's what I'd been looking for.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And so it's you know, I mean, it's ironic because with, you know, the non-objective work, which is what most people think of as abstract, it's actually very concrete because in abstract art, a drip is a drip, a brushstroke is a brushstroke, you know. And so it's very concrete. It's exactly what it is. But in certain artists' work, they make a brushstroke and edges and, but certainly starting with just a brushstroke, they make a brushstroke serve as the symbol for something in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was just magic, absolute magic. First time I saw David do a demo, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was like God, you know, creating something on a canvas. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was, and in retrospect, it wasn't one of his best demos, so that even shows you. It's like, I mean, now I could say it wasn't one of his best demos. But to me, it was like he was doing this portrait, and he did, did something on the forehead, and it was shadow. And then all of a sudden, he did this one brushstroke, and it was bangs out mm-hmm. in front of the shadow. And it was like, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing.
It's like magic.
It was absolutely magic. And so that's the thing that really captured my heart. And I Rembrandt really would be one of the first that really had a sense of that. Titian got a sense of it at the end of his. I would say Titian really began it because he got a sense of what paint could do
mm-hmm.
at the end of his career. You know, and while his work isn't the work that I really look at, I mean, and ironically, I mean, David's work is the work that I primarily have really been drawn to, and Rembrandt also, of course, because he really understood this in such a profound way. I mean, really went into painting in a way that hadn't people hadn't gone into it. So it's so abstract realism is really talking about. You are, you know, representing realism, but what you're doing is very abstract on the canvas, and you're using edges, you're using paint relationships, like color relationship, value relationships, paint quality, and you're doing all this to do something visually on a canvas that only painting can do. And like I said, there are some people in the whole history of art that have really understood this, and those are the ones I'm really drawn to.
We can certainly see the Rembrandt in your paintings. But I do have a question, and that is to achieve the chiaroscuro that you use with special lighting. Do you use the special lighting? Are you imagining that in your mind? Is it?
Oh, no, it's very, very real. Yeah, if you come into my studio, you'll see.
Okay.
So come into my studio. Yeah, in fact, I mean, we went to great lengths, actually, to build studios. I mean, I'm in my perfect studio now. I mean, it's like, I love it. We have slanted north windows, and so the light then comes more from on top rather mm-hmm. than from the side. So we do that. I have three different windows that are about 4 feet by 8 feet, and each one of them has shades on them so that you can adjust a shade from the bottom up and you can adjust a shade from the top down. And so I can really exactly get that window of light just where I want it in the studio.
Oh, wow.
It is amazing. And then I have, painted the walls this kind of very neutral gray-green that allows... it absorbs the light so that you can get very, very strong shadows, and that's really purposeful. So you'll see when you come into the studio. Some friends say it's like coming into a cave.
Really?
Wow. Well, at first, because your eyes have to adjust.
Yeah,
and then it's very dramatic. And then, of course, the light seems really, really dramatic, but you have your eyes have to adjust.
Good for you. No, you've created the perfect environment to create what you do. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, perfect environment. It's really great.
Well, Sherry, I read where you said that you identified the biggest obstacle you faced in your work as the conviction that you must produce a perfect painting the first time. And I think that is a profound... We all struggle with that. And I so identify with the thought that, you know, when you don't get the painting right, and it can mess your whole day up. I mean, you work and you wipe it off because nothing has gone right. I mean, how did you get around that? How, as somebody that is just kind of starting out in my career, how do you do that? How do you just enjoy the process and let it go?
Well, see, in a way, you, Dottie, you have a leg up a little bit because if you're just starting your career, then you've had a whole other life. You know,
right.
And I don't know if you have children or...
I do.
Okay, so you've had a whole other life, and you have a sense of yourself as someone other than an artist, but... You know, you're talking to somebody who started at four, thinking that all she was an artist. So, and that was good in a lot of ways, but bad in some ways because everything that I thought about myself rose and fell on how well I painted or drew that day.
Right.
And ironically, it was that I went through kind of a difficult period in my life where I got more of an appreciation of myself as a human being. And I think that's what has to happen, is you have to have a sense of who you are and to realize that painting is this wonderful, torturous discipline that we elect to be a part of. That, because what we're doing is we are doing problem solving, and not only, and in most of life, you know, problems come up and then people have to learn how to deal with them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in painting, we actually pose those problems.
Right. We create them for ourselves, basically.
Exactly. Now, how masochistic is that?
And then we fix the problem and create another one.
Exactly. And once you get good at solving certain things, you create an even more difficult problem. And, you know, it's interesting because I think that this is, it's one of the life skills that I think the government, the institutions are not understanding how important art is in a person's life.
Right.
And whether it's music or theater or painting or drawing, writing, you know, but to have some appreciation of how the parts fit into the whole and how it really is a problem solving, that there's a beauty to solving a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really one of the best skills any human being can have. So, all of that to say that you know, just to have an appreciation of what you are as a human being. You know, which for me, I mean, like I said, it was, it took a very trying, you know, time to shake all of that up and to make me really appreciate it as a problem solving. You know, and if this doesn't work, then you try that. And but there's some way to solve it. Somebody else has done it. It can be solved, you know. It's not so earth-shaking, you know. So if it doesn't work, it's like, okay. Now, what could I do differently? Or, you know. So, I mean, you're growing at the same time, and that's also, you know, a real benefit to it. If you're paying attention, you're growing with each problem.
Very
and
true.
And that, I think, is very important, that you just keep, you know, keep at it, keep, and when you solve the problems, keep looking for another one to solve, I guess.
Well, there's so much of it's about the journey and not the destination, like we say all the time, but, oh, that is so true. If you don't enjoy the journey, it's not worth it. So true. So, Sherry, where do you, I mean, your paintings are masterpieces. Where do you get the inspiration for your paintings?
Well, from something that is much maligned in the art institutions today. And so in some regard, I'm probably a little bit of a dinosaur, but what I'm inspired by is beauty. So it's where I find that beauty. You know, it might be in, you know, if I'm doing a still life, it might be a certain color combination. It might be, you know, just one particular object and then just a little bit to support that. You know, it might be a beautiful, I mean, it might be a particular kind of face, you know, that you're drawn to, or it could be a room environment. You know, I used to be a guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and so that is always kind of tugging at me because of the, you know, there's so many places in that building that are just, you know, so beautiful. You know, for the size and the proportions of the place, and anyway, so it comes in different ways. And I do some landscape, but that's not the biggest thing that I do. But
so if you're inspired by a still life and you set it up, are you sketching and drawing before you even pick up a paintbrush? I mean, how does that? How do you kind of go from the concept in your head to these amazing paintings?
Well, I spend quite a lot of time doing the setup, and so it was ironic that I had a period of time with my first teacher, Richard Goetz, when I was kind of on the outs with his wife, and so I was in his class, and I think there was maybe a little bit of punishment going on there because he just wouldn't okay my setups. And then he finally okayed them after a month or two, or I don't know. And then he wouldn't tell me why. And then I'd be in the second stage. And you know, but I spent like tons of time setting up still lifes. And at one point, a fellow student, I was talking to him about it and saying, you know, can you believe they did this? And he said, well, you know what? Because when I went to David, I was immediately setting up good still lifes. And that had to come from all that time of, you know, not just rushing into a painting, but taking the time to do something and see what effect it had, do something else, see what effect it had. Mm-hmm. I mean, and not that I was doing any good setups back then, but somehow when I came on to the league with David, he was wanting to paint my setups right away. So it means I was doing something. But I think it was really ironically from this kind of punishment I was getting in Oklahoma.
You were solving your problem.
I was, and I didn't even know it. I was just so young. I mean, you know, I was like 22, 21. So,
do you tend to work in a series? I mean, when you set up a still life and you paint, you know, you paint that, do you tend to use those items again and maybe a little bit of a different way and kind of, or do you move on to something different?
Well, you know, I do have certain objects that I just love, and I do find that, I mean, like I have a lot of objects I've never painted, and I keep looking at them and imagining them in a setup, but I have to have an idea. So mm-hmm. each painting is its own thing. So in that regard, it doesn't feel like it's a series, but it's, but I am drawn to certain things, certain
right.
objects, and I do find that I paint a lot of, I mean, I've got so many objects, but I do tend to paint certain ones over and over and over again.
Does the same work with models?
Yes, although the models, you know, they're not that cooperative. They move away. they do their own intervention and they go away. But I do. I fall in love with certain models, and it's, yes, I do. I do.
I wanted to share this quote with our listeners about painting and how you describe it, because I think it's just amazing. It says, "A painting is more than the subject matter or the story it might depict. Good painting carries an undercurrent of beauty that expresses something beyond subject matter, beyond the tangible reality. It is this level of seeing that makes a painting a living thing, something that speaks even centuries after the artist is gone." That is so beautiful. And I also heard you say before that a painting, and I may get this a little bit wrong, but is more of a duet between the painter and the viewer, that it shouldn't be...
Mm-hmm.
It should be a dance between the two, not just a single thing, not just, you know, just the painter. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Yeah, I'll address the very last thing you said, because it's an interesting thing, because there is a whole movement of realism, you know, and perhaps I mean, it's great that, you know, realism seems to be re-emerging. But there is a whole way of thinking that is more geared towards correctness and
mm-hmm.
and academic correctness and getting in every single thing that you can see, you know, into the painting. And there is it certainly is very impressive, you know, to the viewer. But I guess that where my heart lies is in painting that is more, to me, open, and that it doesn't say everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could make a good analogy for a monologue as opposed to a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great! And great, yeah.
Yeah, and so when you do too much, it's a monologue, and I mean it can
right.
be impressive, but it doesn't engage the viewer. And there should be places that the viewer is able to come in, finish parts, you know, wonder what's happening in a certain, and to me that's kind of the mystery in a painting that is beguiling, that is can be even transformational as the viewer. You know, there was a great story about a great illustrator who was talking about a Rembrandt that he was seeing, had been looking at for 30 years, and every time he went to see it, he saw more in it. And so I think that the really great work has that quality. The longer you
right.
look at it, the better it gets. And it's not because of all the detail. It's because of the way that artist was seeing. And again, I think in a more open way, certainly that when I look at paintings that have that open quality, I mean, they can have a lot of detail. It's not that. It's the idea behind it, which again, you know, comes back to the idea of this abstract realism. When you have a visual idea that you're doing in the painting, and that there's, you know, there can be depth in a sketch, there can be depth in something that you take further, and I think that a lot of it has to do with the intent, you know, the intent of the artist, and I think that that's, you know, what make something have something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what makes Mozart above? I was listening to the radio yesterday, and this one musician, they were playing a minor artist of the Mozart's time. And she said, I think it's really important to play these people too, because then you have some sort of point of reference. Because if we're always looking at the exceptional, I mean, it was just kind of an interesting comment, you know,
right.
because
yeah.
we take it for granted. We listen to Mozart or Beethoven or Brahms and just how remarkable they are. But, you know, how good to listen to somebody who was good, a good craftsman, but not as remarkable, what was missing. And it was really interesting to hear it
mm-hmm.
because it was lacking something. Now, I'm not a musician, so I wouldn't have been able to put it into words. And people that are, you know, looking at paintings and they're not painters, they won't necessarily know what's missing, but I think that it's, you know, people that are more paying more attention, they see that something else has something more, and
right.
I mean, I'm certainly not, I can't define what that is or, you know, have the definitive answer for that, but I do know that some work has more, and
right.
it is somehow more appealing and more, and has longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Those paintings that pull you back in, that keep pulling you back in, and sometimes you can't, you don't really even know why. And that's the
yeah.
magic, I think, that happens.
Well, it is. It is, Dottie. I mean, it's, you know, and this has to do with having an appreciation for what an abstract visual idea is. And certainly, you know, when you just begin, it's going to be more limited. And then, but as you keep going into it, as you keep painting, paying attention, those ideas start to have depth. Those ideas go deeper so that you could do a sketch and it could have more in it, you know, as well as, of course,
right.
taking a painting further, you know.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
You know.
Well, I know.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
I was going to tell our listeners when I was doing research for this show that there are some videos out there of Sherry talking about some things. And one of the videos I saw had to do with your philosophies about the differences between drawing and painting. And I'd love for you to share that because I think it's really, really interesting. Really interesting.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was first studying with David LaFell, he would talk about how painting and drawing were two different languages, and, you know, I accepted it, and, you know, even when I started teaching, I started saying it, but I didn't understand it for quite a while. And when I started to write my book on, you know, on drawing, the language of drawing, it was when I really began to really see the difference between the two. And so drawing is a language that really we all come into the world knowing. I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, you guys, what, Leslie, do you have kids also?
I have three boys all in college right now.
Okay. You've been through it, got them out. But I'm sure that when your kids were young, I'm sure there was no hesitation when it was time to draw a house,
mm-hmm.
draw a
yeah.
son. You know, they just go right at it.
True.
So there's somehow we just know this language, this linear language when we're young, and this symbolism that comes with it. You know, how to make a head, so a head becomes a circle.
Right.
You know, eyes become circles, a mouth becomes a line. And if you think about it, these are really amazing symbolism. It's amazing symbolism to abstract from reality and make these linear marks that give
right.
that tell people exactly what that is. I mean, it's amazing. So we come into this world knowing that language. So how painting progressed is that it started out as drawing,
mm-hmm.
and then they colored in that drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, but the one thing that, even when they were doing that with the icons, the one thing that they understood, though, is that they couldn't just do a drawing and have it read, you know, something linear and have it read from the back of a church or all the way across a palace, you know, room. So painting, it has to communicate from a distance, and drawing doesn't. And that's their big differences. So in drawing, you and we're always trying to make form, right? I mean, if you're a realist,
right,
and you're trying to convey form. So the way you do it in drawing is you model edges, darker, you model the edges, you know, darker to an edge in
right.
order to give the illusion that it has form. Okay. Now from, and we model in the shadow to create the form, we model in the light to create the form. And so that's all very, very comfortable for everybody. I mean, because again, you know, we come into this world with that language. And drawings, again, they were like private things that an artist would pull out and show a collector when they would come into the studio. But they weren't framed. They weren't put up on the walls. You know, these were their studies. So you viewed them very close. But then paintings, there was just a whole other demand on painting, and that was that it had to convey an image from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the big difference. And you can't do what works in drawing for painting. So
mm-hmm.
painting's not a linear language.
Right.
It's a language of shapes. And so, you know, if just going by a billboard and how images are created on a billboard, you know, they cut out, if it's a figure, they cut out the figure and put a blank, you know, a solid background behind it, or, you know, it's all based on very simple shapes. And so that's what they learned very young. And so anyway, but painting evolved, but that was the idea, is that you had to have simple shapes for it to read from a distance. So
mm-hmm.
that's the biggest difference between the two languages.
So
there's a whole way that you make form
yeah.
in painting.
Yeah.
You take a flat shape, and there's a way that you make that look dimensional and
right.
still look like a flat shape. So, you know, that's the miracle of it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you talked about your studio a little while ago, but there's kind of a funny story about that's not the first studio, right? The one that you're working
right.
in now.
Right.
Can you
right.
share that story?
We want to hear this.
You want to hear this story. Yeah, this is two dedicated artists because, you know, we were in New York, you know, David and I. We bought a house out here. And
Taos, for those of you
in Taos.
Know.
I'm
near
sorry.
Taos.
Yes, out here near Taos, a little north of Taos. And we couldn't move here until we had studios, right? Because you can't have a day without a studio. So,
of course.
So we, you know, came out and got a contractor and got the whole thing set up and told them we wanted, you know, our studios to face true north. Well, we assumed they did that. We came out and found that they had poured the foundation, and it wasn't true north. It was northwest. And so what would happen is in the summertime, when it's so delightful and you can paint
mm-hmm.
until 7:30 or 8 at night, I mean, because we both work with natural light, the sun would start coming in about 3:30 or 4 and basically kind of would ruin the light. And so we couldn't keep painting. So we built new studios so that they're facing the right direction. So we turned our old studios into living space and a dining room and a living room, and then which we did need. We had a very small house. And then we angled the studios, and now they're about 10 degrees east of true north, so that where we are, we'll get a little bit of sun in the morning, but then it's gone for the day. And the way we work much more, you know, into the day. You know, the morning is to clear out phone calls and
mm-hmm.
emails and that kind of thing.
Right.
And then we work until the light is gone.
Wow. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you use the same contractors for the second
No.
two?
No. We wised up.
I mean, I'm just thinking that they probably thought, "What is she talking about? What do you mean? There's this big of a difference."
Right. So. It doesn't matter.
In that video, Sherry, you're standing in your studio, and the walls do look really dark. And I know you
yes.
said it's a green something or
I
other.
I love that color, though. It's sort of a greenish gray. I mean, it's almost a non-color.
Well, you know how that began is that the Art Students League has dark walls in all the studios.
Mm-hmm.
But they have it kind of a battleship gray. And so when we had studios in Manhattan, you know, I think, I mean, David had gotten some sort of a gray for the walls or something. And then one day we went downstairs and he was about to move into another studio. So we went down to get a better, you know, paint color and just went through paint colors. And at that time, Benjamin Moore, which was at that time a good paint, they had this GN25 and it was just seemed like the perfect color. And so that's kind of how it began, but it was a little bit greener than what we have now. And so over the years, it's evolved. And when we came out here to Taos, we came up with a color that a local paint company, I think now has as Sherry McGraw Green or something.
Oh, wow.
How cool is that?
But we had found it again, I think in, I think it was in Benjamin Moore. We had found the color and they had, let's see, oh, I'm trying to think. It did have a name, but then they changed it. So I won't tell you the name because then you'll get that. And somehow changed it and became like this awful green. So now it's not that color. And we mixed a whole color that is just the perfect color. Because it's not really green and it's not red. It has a little more red in it, and so that it just becomes this incredible neutral color and everything looks good against it. You know, everything looks lit, and, you know, because basically everything you're painting is warm, you know,
right.
I mean, you know, blood, people, and different things. And so this gray-green just goes back, and so everything comes in front of it. It's just like the perfect color. And, you know, I keep meaning to do it, but I'll post it on my website and on the, which I'll tell you, you know, SherryMcGraw.com and then BrightLightFineArt.com. So I'll get it posted.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So I think you're working on a show that you're going to do in Ohio in 2014. Is that right?
That's right. So
well,
yeah,
tell
now
us tell us about it. It's a long way away.
It is a long way away. although, you know, it's not long enough away because, of course, I want to have you know, my best work in the show. It's going to be at the Butler Institute of American Art, and I have to sing the praises of this particular museum because they've had shows for American realists where other museums won't. And so they really do recognize the realist artists of today, and some of the prominent artists of our time have had solo shows there. So I'm very, very excited about it. Lou Zona, who's the director, you know, is brave enough to be, you know, putting on realist shows in a time when beauty and realism is just it's not acceptable in the art institutions. So it's going to be a solo show of paintings. It'll be part retrospective. I'll borrow some of my my favorite pieces back, and I'll also have drawings in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be pretty comprehensive. So
wow.
And
I wonder.
Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that will be such a great body of work. Between the drawings and the paintings, and then, and you're right, 2014, we'll get here quickly.
Yeah, we'll get here too quickly. Because, well, you know, we'll do a catalog, so of course everything's going to have to be done in time for that,
right.
You know, to do the catalog. But in fact, I'm flying out there this next week to see the room and, you know, to really see, you know, visualize it and give me a better idea of how much, you know, new work I need to paint.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'll just be painting my little tushy off till then. So,
so now you do a lot of workshops every year. Will you tell me about your workshops? What if I'm coming to one? What can I expect?
Oh, okay. Well, great, because you just might come to one, right? The one in Atlanta. So I'll give you a preview. Well, I mean, basically, You know, I usually, in most still lifes, I do, I mean, in most workshops, I do both still life and portrait and figure. So that way, you know, sometimes people just want to do portrait and figure. Sometimes they just want to do still life. And sometimes I like to do both. So it's kind of nice to give them all those options. And so I'll start the week out with a still life demonstration and explaining, you know, what I'm, you know, this whole thing of the abstract idea, you know, behind a painting and how you start the painting. So, and then there's a lot of private critiques. You know, that afternoon what I'll do the first day is those that are doing still life, I help them with their setup so that we make sure that every still life has an idea. And then once you understand what that idea is, then it's a matter of just doing that idea. And as I've said before, that, you know, most of the problems that people have is just when they go away from their idea. And so, you know, I mean, I'm sure all of you guys have had the experience that a painting just seems to paint itself. It works, you know, just beginning to end. And it's because you knew just what you wanted to do visually, and that's exactly what you did. And you didn't let any extraneous information creep in. You just did that. And so usually we just, we're, instead of that, we see something else and we put that in and we, oh, this looks interesting, and you put that in and you end up having several ideas and you've gone off of the idea. And anyway, and so, and then on Wednesday I do a portrait or figure demo, usually if that's included in the workshop. And then and the rest of the time I do critiques. So it's interesting. It's really interesting. I love to find out where each person is, what they need to learn, and I try to help them, you know, do what they would like to do to achieve in their work. So it's for me, from a teacher standpoint, it's just really entertaining.
Hopefully in a good way.
And then, Sherry, you have a workshop coming up in April in Atlanta, you said, right?
Yes. We're organizing that right now, and it will be on my website and also on the Bright Light Fine Art website. And it's a place, I don't quite know the town's name right now, but it's about 20 minutes outside of Atlanta. And it should be quite a wonderful thing. There's a student of mine down there who's helping us organize it. And as per those wonderful people from the South, and it will be very gracious and I think really, really a lovely workshop. So I'm looking forward to it. We have it scheduled right before the Portrait Society of America conference, which is going to be in Atlanta this year. So I'll be also participating in that conference. So.
And then any other upcoming workshops you have scheduled, are there any out now, or should people just go to your website to find those?
Okay, I'm not doing anything now until that one in Atlanta, and then right after that I do one in Baltimore at Matt Zoll's studio.
Okay, got
it. I talked to him the other day, and I think there's maybe 4 spots left, so I think you're going to have to hurry if you want to get into that one. And then I have one scheduled in Bend, Oregon, the Art in the Mountains. And because I went there this past year and I saw this this one rock that they have there that is so stunning that I'm going to go there early and paint that that place. Smith Rock is what it's called. It's just unusual. And that whole area is just stunning. So I just wanted to go and do some plein air work. Anyway, so I'm going to go back up there, and Tracy, who runs it, is just the most accommodating, you know, lovely, lovely woman, and it really runs beautifully. And I do both still life and portrait up there as well.
Oh, wonderful. Sounds
so cool. I'm not, other than that, I haven't scheduled anything, so, because I'm pretty much just going to be painting. So
I was going to say, you have a busy year. You know, I did read that you had mentioned that generally painting problems arise from one mistake, and that is when information irrelevant to the visual concept creeps into the painting, usually with the excuse, but it was there. And how can artists learn to edit out the irrelevant parts of a painting? Because I had just had this conversation in the workshop I taught last week. It's so important to understand just because it's there, it doesn't need to be in your painting.
Right, right. Yeah, I think people need to realize that there really is an artistic license
mm-hmm. yes.
that needs to be used. And, you know, what's interesting is that the layman sees everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they look at something, they see everything. Mm-hmm. And what the artist is doing is they're looking and putting in what is relevant to the idea. And so the biggest way in which you could learn how to edit out is that you have to have an idea.
Right.
You have to know what that idea is. And you have to see when this has nothing to do with that idea. Mm-hmm. Putting that in has nothing to do with the idea. I mean, I remember there was this little still life I was doing, and it was a very, very simple thing. It was this dried hydrangea, you know, stem and these flowers, just a very simple thing. And it was leaning on this little amber glass, and then maybe there were, I think, a couple of little shallots or you know, little onions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very simple idea. And I kept painting these, painting it, and then I'd paint the leaves, and I had had them in a beautiful little shape, and then I'd start to put in the information I was seeing there, and it would break it up, and it wouldn't look good anymore. And so I'd bring it back to a shape, and then I'd put the information in. I don't know how many times I went back and forth until I realized that that information didn't have to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That as shapes, they would read, and as dark shapes, that's what their purpose was in the painting, you know, to be these beautiful,
right.
simple shapes, dark
mm-hmm.
shapes,
right.
shadow shapes. And even though I was seeing other information in there, it was not helping the painting to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the kind of thing that happens every time you go, you know, that you're looking at something to paint it.
Well,
you see, you have to know what
the idea
is.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to know what the idea is.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you will definitely put in, you know, information that just isn't part of that idea, just isn't necessary.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't make sense sometimes.
Right, right. I know I was thinking about this one painting I saw at this of a Velasquez, and it was this full figure. The man was in black. He had on black stockings and black shoes. And it was virtually one black shape. I mean, there was, you know, very, very subtle suggestion of, you know, form and the actual material and everything, but it was so, so subtle that really you read it as this big black shape. And then you see the head and the hands and the collar, the white collar, and then the background being basically very simple. And so he had to consciously do that, because looking at that black, he would have seen so much more of actual value variation than
right.
he put in.
Yeah.
And you just have to realize this is a real conscious decision, that what he wanted was this big black shape,
mm-hmm.
big dark shape. And so then you really go to the head and the hands. It is so striking. And it would have been less striking had he put in more information and more value variation in that black. But it was there. It was definitely there. Yeah, it just makes you realize you have to consciously make choices.
Although sometimes we make them and we don't realize we're making them.
That's right, Leslie. That's right.
We're consciously doing it without realizing it.
And then
right,
we have a bad
probably.
Day.
Yeah. There's Swiper right there.
Exactly.
And the lesson learned and the problem not solved.
That's true.
What you had said earlier, what's your typical day like? You do your emails and take care of all that in the morning and then paint in the afternoon, or how do you structure your day? And is it the same all the time when you're home?
Well, that's a great question, because one of the big perks, I think, to having to being an artist is that life is it does change all the time. You know, there might be some days when you're packing up paintings. There might be some days, at least for me, that I might be doing Sgraffito on a frame. you know, there might be some days that end up just getting lost to phone calls or something. But the intent is always to be in the studio. So, you know, that's always the intent. And I like to get things off of my plate in the morning. So I do like to, you know, do any business stuff or answering phone calls or things like that early. And then I put a message on my phone machine that says to call when the light is gone. So
great.
Everybody should do that. So
I might feel that.
They think artists don't have a job, so they can call them anytime.
Very true.
But,
that's a wonderful.
Yes, I'm always trying to get in the studio. So,
well, that's where you belong. I mean, what the paintings are creating, please spend your time there. I know you obviously paint still life, portrait, and figure painting. Is there one that you prefer to paint over the other? Just curious.
No, not really. But usually, like, if you've, let's say that you've been doing a still life and maybe it's been taking a while and you finally finish a still life, then it's kind of fun to change, at least
sure.
for me, to, you know, then have a model in or, you know, maybe go out and paint a landscape or, you know, do an interior or, you know, I just like it, you know, changing things up. And, yeah, so no, I really don't have a preference. I mean, it used to be still life, I would say. And I've gotten, you know, more and more into figurative work and interiors, which I don't do a lot of them, but I do like to do that sort of thing. I did one night scene, or I've done it a few times, of this ceremony that they do at the Taos Pueblo here. And so that's kind of unusual, but and that's done from memory, that one. So, you know, I like trying a lot of different things and figuring out how I can possibly paint things that I find really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
When it's, you know, like not something like that, a ceremony out of doors, you can't paint it, photograph it, or sketch it. So,
right, definitely. Well, that's the one on your website, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. That's the one, the Night of the Night
yes.
Fires.
Yes. Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
I am very curious what it is like to share your life with another incredibly talented and gifted artist. I can't imagine. do you and David ever paint together?
We do. Sometimes we'll hire a model and paint together. So, but in terms of doing a still life, we don't. I mean, I think I painted a still life with him once, years and years and years ago. But no, basically we keep, you know, very separate studios. And just if we hire a model, sometimes we'll, you know, paint them together. But David has different ideas with the model than I do. So I tend to want to have the model myself so that I can do some things
uh-huh.
that he wouldn't do, and he'll do things that I wouldn't do, that kind of thing. So, but what it's
talk
like
about art all the time. I'm just curious. I mean, you know, my husband comes home and talks about commercial real estate and sports, and I'm thinking, wow, if we were both artists, it would be cool, but maybe it wouldn't. I'm not sure.
Well, okay, yeah, for those listeners that don't realize, so I ended up, I'm with my teacher, David A. LaFell, and have been now for 35 years. So, you know, it's been interesting because I met him when I was just a child. And so I've, you know, grown up with him, and we've evolved, you know, from the student-teacher relationship to peers, and that certainly has come with its growing pains. You can only imagine, and I'll let you imagine. you know, I was thinking that what it's like, I'll tell you what it's like. I mean, first of all, the great part of it is that he would never even think of being jealous or think it's strange that I'm in the studio working. So it's lovely on both
mm-hmm.
our parts.
Sure.
You know, and sometimes if you have a non artist partner, they, you know, they kind of get jealous of all this time that's being spent in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're artist, there's no thought of that. So that
right.
is lovely. You know, we never have any conflict in that regard. But it is a little bit like if you had had Brahms composing in one room and Freudian slip. and then you had Beethoven in the other room. And every night, Brahms went in and would hear what Beethoven had done that day, had composed that day. It was a little bit like that for me, learning about painting that way. Because every day, to see how much better he was and how much more he understood. You know, in some regards, I mean, it's been the most incredible privilege that any human being could have. I mean, David knows more about painting than anybody that I know of,
mm-hmm.
and has gone into it in a way that I don't know anyone else that has. And so, and he's my favorite artist. So, I mean, here I get to be with my favorite artist in the history of art and
wow.
and develop. But the problem with that is just that it's hard. I mean, I was already very self-critical, so it was really hard to not be, to have any appreciation for anything I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh, wow.
yeah. and the beauty of a student usually is that they get to leave their teacher.
Right.
Right.
You know, so
that
you
didn't
you,
work.
It didn't work. So I don't want to complain about it, but it did come with its own set of things to deal with. That you know, so if you do get to leave your teacher, it's actually is a, you know, there is a perk to that, because you get to have some sense of your own development and appreciate
mm-hmm.
where you are, and not be thinking, I want to be 20 years down the road.
Right.
You know, and so that makes it a little more challenging. And I know Brahms even mentioned that. He said how hard, I mean, it took him forever to write his first symphony because he felt the heavy footsteps of Rembrandt, you know, behind him.
Yeah.
And I mean, of Beethoven rather,
mm-hmm.
behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been challenging, but you know, incredible.
Sure. Wow. Well, that's interesting. Do you have a lock on your studio door in case you don't want anyone to see?
I do have a lock. And there are times like he'll come in and he can tell by my body language if I don't want him anywhere near the easel.
Go away.
Go away. No comments.
Well, I want to swing back a little bit. I know we talked about drawing a little while ago, but I'm probably know the answer to this question. I'm not even sure why I'm asking it. But, you know, there's a lot of artists out there and those who listen to our program who are learning on their own and don't have formal training. And do you think every artist should think about taking drawing classes as an important element to an artist's success?
Well, you know, it's funny. Now, success, I'm with you until that last word. It depends
and
on how you
can be in their own mind. You know, and
exactly.
That's what I'm referring to.
Okay, great. Okay, because certainly I don't think that, you know, those kind of wonderful skills are appreciated by, you know, today's art institutions, I'll put it that way,
mm-hmm.
and that might, you know, contribute to some sort of financial success. But in terms of becoming a really good artist, it is absolutely adamant that you should learn how to draw. And I'll tell you why. It isn't maybe for the reason that a lot of people first coming into it might think is the reason to learn how to draw. Because today we have all kinds of mechanical devices where you can project images onto a canvas, you could draw around it, and so a lot of people might think that it's, you know, then why do you need to learn how to draw? You can just go, you know, straight to painting. But what drawing does is it really begins.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, I think we lost her.
Did we lose her?
We did. I'm hoping she'll call right back. Hmm. I do hope she will. Yeah, I'm sure she will call right back. So anyway, Dottie, are you ready to go back and take a drawing class?
I am. You know, and I that is the only thing I did in college. The only classes I took in college were drawing classes. I didn't paint until I was in my 30s, I guess. I always drew. I never put color, I guess. So I agree with her. I think I have friends that cannot draw well, and they struggle, I think, a lot of times above and beyond where they need to be because of the lack of that skill. They just kind of jumped right into painting without taking those steps.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I do read a lot though about how many artists are going back and taking drawing classes and really trying to, you know, kind of do that continuing education thing, which I think is so important.
Right.
Really,
well,
really
I think
important.
Also when you draw, I mean, I grew up drawing a lot, and now I paint more than I draw, and it helps to go back and forth, I think, because you, it's like anything else. If you don't do it enough, you lose ground. You know, it will come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
With some effort, but you tend to
hold on.
You know,
call right back. We lost you. Okay. Great.
I just called her. She's going to call right back.
I think it's just one of those skills that you really need to constantly use.
Well, I don't know how you could paint if you didn't know how to draw. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, I
because
agree.
It's
but
the
I,
process.
But I think there are. Yeah.
Yeah, and even if you're painting shapes, which we all try to do, you still have to understand that part of it. I don't know. It's very, very interesting. Okay, and here she is. So, Sherry?
Yes.
You're back.
I'm back. I don't know what happened. There was a click and we were gone.
We just lost you. But Donnie and I were discussing how we're both going to go back and take drawing classes.
Oh, great. Let me explain then. So the thing about drawing is that it gets you to see the way an artist sees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main thing. It gets you to be able to see things and understand what you're looking at on a structural level, on a gestural level, which is also amazing. I mean, I know, I don't know, have you guys had C.W. Mundy on your show?
We have.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yeah, he was on about a month ago.
Oh, okay. Well, C.W. took my drawing workshop. And he had had...
He actually mentioned that on the show.
Oh, he did? He mentioned
it
on the show.
He did.
And I have never seen anyone make such a transformation in just 4 days. It was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen.
Wow.
You know, because he had just never been taught, you know, about gesture and... which was one of the big things that really, you know, that and then making the drawings dimensional. And it's what it does is it changes how you see what you're looking at, and there's just no substitute for it because again you're in a language that's very familiar, and it's a simple language, and it allows you to study the world and understand it structurally, gesturally, you know, in terms of form, dimension, you know, weight, you know, all of these qualities. So really what it's doing, it's heightening your sensitivity. That's what drawing does. It heightens your sensitivity to what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no substitute for it. So that then when you get into painting, which is a much more complex language, you have this tremendous sensitivity that you've built up and understanding about the world that you're looking at. So it's just invaluable.
When you were growing up, did you draw a lot, or did you move into painting earlier or later? I know when I was growing up, I drew constantly as a child and really did not put color to form until I was in my 30s. I lived in the land of black and white, I guess. But how did you make that transition, and was it an easy one for you to move from drawing to painting?
Well, it's always a difficult, I mean, for me, let's see. You know, when I did get to David, and
then I really did leap right into painting. And my drawing was decent, you know. I could, you know, it was decent enough. And then there was a whole lot that I had to learn about drawing. You know, I kind of started all over again with the drawing. But no, I mean, I went right into painting, I think, because I had had so much drawing. I mean, that is what
right.
I had done, was just I had drawn. So, but yeah. Yeah.
Well,
so, I mean, I think it's a, it is kind of a difficult transition, just because everybody wants to make form in painting the way you do it in drawing. And
right, and I think that's a hurdle to jump over, I think. To me, it was.
Yeah, it is. It is. But everybody's got to learn painting the same way that you have to learn about, you know, making shapes and using paint and to make, you know, to control paint. And that's probably the biggest hurdle that everybody has when they begin to paint is to learn how to manipulate it and not be afraid of it.
Yes, I think so. Well, this is a good segue to talk about your book that I'm waiting on that's going to come soon, I'm sure. I can't wait to get started.
It was shipped yesterday.
Yay! The Language of Drawing is the name of the book.
Dottie, can you talk a little louder? Sorry.
Sorry. Can you not hear me? What is my phone? Okay. Turn the volume up.
Perfect.
The description of the book reads, McGraw demystifies the ancient art and gives license to artists and laymen alike to hone their visual skills with her logical approach. McGraw says it this way, we all know this language. We were born with it. A child makes linear symbols for the world without hesitation, and that is why their scrawls have such universal appeal, which is what you talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The artist then develops a deeper understanding of this natural language. Can you tell us why you decided to write this book and the thoughts behind it, I guess?
Yes. Well,
the small little project.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know it took me about 10 years to do it. I mean, it was really,
wow.
You know, and 5 years.
A labor of
years,
love, maybe.
It was a labor of love. And 5 years of that was prior to the computer. And I have to say the computer just absolutely made it happen because my way of writing is that I'm always rewriting so quickly that it would get to a place where I couldn't even read it. So the first 5 years, in a way, were kind of a waste, but not really, because it was getting me into it. But, well, the reason I wrote it is because I felt that what had happened is that there was a change in the way drawing was being taught, and that when David was learning how to draw, they at Parsons School of Design, they had two different classes. So they would have an anatomy class where you were learning anatomy, and then they would have a drawing class where you really learned what drawing was.
Uh-huh.
And somehow the drawing part of it fell away, and it had gotten to where drawing classes, anatomy, that was the only thing that was being taught was anatomy. And the whole art of drawing itself was lost. And so I didn't feel that it was, I mean, it just seemed that that needed to be brought up again, because what was happening is that people were not wanting to draw because it was going back to that very academic way of drawing, which, you know, working from casts and doing all of that,
right.
Which for most people was so discouraging. I mean, for a lot of people, because it's not very fun.
Yeah.
That, you know, that I think it was making people feel that, you know, well, I don't want to learn how to draw. And the biggest compliment that I get, and the thing that I love to hear, is that when people read the book and it makes them want to draw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where they get excited about drawing again. And just like, you know, CW, I mean, he was like, he's like the poster child. He just loves drawing now. And, you know, it opens up an entire connection to the world that artists have, you know, that other people don't have. I mean, we could go to Europe with a sketch pad and a pencil and capture everything we see,
mm-hmm.
you know,
from the ocean to buildings to birds flying, and in other words, there's just nothing that's beyond a pencil and paper, and it's
right.
So freeing to have that. You can capture something and a connection to reality that is with something so simple, the pencil and paper.
Well, people, artists that have your book talk about it like it's kind of like the Bible that's in their studio. And I have a friend who said for me to ask you about, because she just read it, how you differentiate between drawing an object, you know, like still life, and a living, breathing person.
Well, you don't have to pay the still life.
True. It doesn't move and breathe. And
it doesn't move.
And blink. And
it's much cheaper. But, you know, I really don't differentiate. I really approach them both the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is even something that's inanimate has a gesture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, I start gesturally, and if it's, you know, a real thing, it has dimension, and it has weight, and it has texture, and it has, you know, all these things. So even though it isn't moving, that makes it, you know, easier. But it still has all these things, and that's the same way you approach it.
And a lot of people probably didn't realize that. Now, I understand there might be another book on the horizon, maybe in less than 10 years or not.
Oh, yeah, definitely less than 10 years. I mean, part of that time that it took with the drawing book is that I had to learn how to write. You know, so I had kind of just a funny aside. I had a good editing session early on in the manuscript with the drawing, and they were. I had a little bit of a whining attitude about it. You know, like nobody wants to draw anymore. And they said that they read it, and they said, and they were very diplomatic. They said, you know, it makes us want to paint.
Oh.
We're like, ouch.
Ooh, that wasn't my intention.
Exactly. But it was great. I had some great editing experiences, some really brilliant editors that helped me along the way and made me realize what I was not doing. And so I had to learn how to write. So now I feel like I have some idea about that. And so, no, it's not going to take 10 years.
What tells what the book's about or what it
yes.
is?
Well, it is a book on painting, and really about, you know, concepts, about this abstract realism and having a visual concept in a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So a daunting task, but a lot of fun, actually. I'm really enjoying writing it. So as the winter comes and the light goes at around 4 o'clock, you know, around the winter time, then I come up here and write. So
When do you think you would like for us to be able to look out for it?
Oh.
How's that for being big?
Well, you know, the ambitious part of me would love to have it ready by my show at the Butler, but I think that it, you know, I'm looking more to maybe 3 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think that it's going to be a lot to try to get the show and a catalog and another book done in that
right.
time.
No,
I'm a little bit of an overachiever, but I don't think I can manage that.
Yeah, and I did want to mention that your drawing book is available at brightlightfineart.com. So anybody that wants to purchase it can go there. And then you also have some DVDs available, right?
I do, you know, and I have that site, the Bright Light Fine Art. There, we have an idea, especially since I'm, you know, David is part of this site as well, and our friend Jackie Kamen, who's also an excellent painter,
mm-hmm.
and so we're doing something because I know David's going to be teaching less, certainly for the next couple of years, I'll be teaching less. A way of reaching out to people, and so we're creating this artist guild where you can belong to it, and you would have access to different videos that we're doing, and then we're also planning on doing some live on class, you know, live streaming on class online classes. So,
oh wow!
that's going to come. And so if they're at all interested, they could go to Bright Light Fine Art and at least indicate that you have an interest to hear about it and, you know, sign up just, you know, to get some information on it. And then we'll, you know, it's all in the formation stage right now, but I think it'll come out pretty soon. I think maybe by December 10th.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great for people that can't make, you know, one of your workshops.
Yes, and right. And there are a lot of people that have contacted me over the years that, you know, I can't travel there, but, you know.
Right.
And so this would be one way to have that access. So
that's
wonderful.
Great. Hmm. What advice do you have for someone like me who is just launching their art career? And there are a lot of us out there, I think. Seems like more and more every day.
I think so. As this one friend of mine said, who's a sculpture instructor at this university down in Texas, he said, "You know, of course, that we're, you know, we're teaching people to be our competition, right?" I thought, huh, I never thought about it that way. Well, you know, it's interesting.
You're
not
in any danger from me. So.
Nor me, so you're fine.
So you can share your wisdom with me.
Well, I would do it anyway. I mean, I really just love teaching. It's something I've actually done since before I met David. I just think when I thought, yeah, I have to make some money, I thought, I'll teach. I don't know where that came from. But maybe for my dad. My dad was a good teacher of golf, so he was a good golf instructor. Well, what advice? Well, you know, I think I'd have to have a more specific, you know, question about, I mean, you know, my how I learned all of this is probably a little bit from another era, because there was a time when all you had to do, and this is what drove David as well, all you had to do was be really good, and then you would get noticed.
Right.
And I think today it's different, because there are so many people, and there's so many people that are good at marketing.
Right.
That you're competing against. You're just really ratcheted up, you know, exponentially from when I started out, and so. I think I was a little bit naive, thinking that you could just be really excellent and that's all you'd have to do. And now I'm seeing that it's not the case, that, you know, marketing is just a fact of the whole business of painting. I mean, at one time, galleries really were doing the business end of it for artists.
Right.
You know, much more so than today. And now that doesn't happen. They have huge stables. They're not really promoting careers for the most part, and that's all being left to the artists. So it's become a fact of life, I think, that you have to promote your career. You have to
right.
do all of that.
True. What's on your to-do list or wish list in the next 5 years? Although I think we probably now we've talked about it. Anything you haven't mentioned?
You know, just to get better. You know, I'm always posing more problems and wanting to get better, and that's, you know, maybe traveling to Europe a little bit more might be interesting too. You know, I think that it's interesting. You get to a certain point in your development, and there's some days you wake up and you think, you know, I hate the way I paint.
Oh, love to hear that.
I'm not sure that I do or not. If you, amazing. Wow.
You know, and there's going to be days like that where you just think, you know, something's got to change. And those are great moments, because, you know, change never happens because you're just happy. And it only happens because you're dissatisfied. And so, you know, people that, you know, and so I'm always excited when I start to have that feeling, because I think, oh, great, you know, now what's on the horizon? Because, you know, and even though it may not be obvious to people from the outside, but there are, you know, major shifts that happen in a career. And I think you have to be open to that.
You know, when you think, oh, I don't like anything I'm doing right now, it's great, you know, because it means now you're ready to really, you know, give up, change. You're not holding on to anything or, you know, being precious about what you're doing, and you're willing to do something that you've never done before. And then in those moments, something really amazing can happen.
Very, very true.
Yeah.
Darkest before dawn. You know,
yes.
The saying goes. And I've always heard that, you know, when you start, when you struggle with your paintings, that something good is coming soon. You're about to make, you know, there's a change that is about to be made, and you just have to kind of be patient and wait for
right.
it to come.
That's true, Dottie, and usually how it feels is that you think you're going backwards.
Mm-hmm.
You think you're getting worse, and it's a sure sign something's happening because
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, it's like because we get better and plateau for a while.
Right.
And then there's always a shake-up, and you're going to feel like you're going backwards, and it's because you're on the verge of something new, something else.
Important
so
statement
good.
To remember.
That enjoy is backwards.
Yes.
Yeah. That's wonderful. We just have some quick questions I'm going to ask at the end. We've kind of run out of time, but this is still being recorded. They're very simple answers, Sherry, as you know. So the first question is, what is your favorite art book?
Okay. Well, you know, I actually, that is a little hard to say because...
I know.
But, you know, oddly, there is Whistler's Pastels that he did of Venice. It's actually one of my favorite books. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, and I don't have the name right here in front of me. But if you just look for Whistler's Pastels, it's his little sketches he did of Venice. And I just think they're so beautiful, as are the Turner watercolors that he did of Venice as well. So you can see I kind of have something about Venice.
I do, which is wonderful. Do you have a favorite paint color?
No.
No. And what kind of music do you listen to when you paint, or do you even listen to music?
I do, and I like... operatic, usually female operatic work is a lot of what I like to listen to.
Wonderful. Whose art do you wish you could add to your collection?
This one still life painter, Hafsa Pushman. And then there's one painting at the Getty that's on loan at the Getty that's a Rembrandt, and it's this little portrait of a rabbi, and I'd love to have that.
Well, hopefully someone's listening that can make that happen. other than getting the right light the first time, do you have a studio tip for our listeners?
Uh-huh. Yeah, put on your phone machine, you know, call when the light's gone.
That's a great one. That's a great one. What's on your easel right now?
Actually, right now, I'm doing a pastel of this Chinese artifact, this ribbon dancer. I'm doing a pastel.
Mm-hmm. And last question, who would you like to paint with, or workshop would you like to take?
You know, I've been thinking that it would be really curious to go into one of David's workshops.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd love that.
He would, actually.
You should.
Well, because there are things that happen in a workshop that can be just, it's a whole different dynamic.
Absolutely. Well, Sherry, thank you so much. What an amazing interview. This has been incredible.
You guys are the greatest. This has been so much fun.
And we've been laughing, and I tell you, it's very motivating, and I've learned so much. And like I said, for all of our listeners, and there's a lot of them, I'm pleased to say you need to go to Sherry McGraw's website and look at her art and look at her DVDs and look at all her YouTube videos and everything and just learn more about what an incredible body of work and kind of philosophy you have for all artists, because it's highly motivating and absolutely wonderful. So thank you.
Thank you, mm-hmm. Leslie. Thank you so much. And thank you, Dottie. You guys are very easy to work with.
We have fun.
I feel like I know you already.
Oh, good. I hope to see you in April, too.
That's right.
In Atlanta.
Great.
I'll be checking.
Good idea. That's wonderful. Well, listen, thank you very much. I know we've kind of gone over our time, but it's really been a terrific show. And we'll talk to everyone next week.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.